You ever watch this guy on television?
You all were not telling the truth, and you should not be trusted.
Congressman Matt Gaetz, thank you for what you did for your country tonight.
Be offended with the Democratic whip, not House Republicans.
Like a machine, Matt Gaetz.
Welcome to Hot Takes. I'm Congressman Matt Gaetz. Let's talk about the news. Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe, my former colleague in the House of Representatives, making news with very significant disclosures regarding the setup of President Trump and General Michael Flynn by the FBI during the Obama-Biden administration. I'll walk you through the specifics and how it relates to the overall Russia hoax endeavor. You'll remember that at the end of July, the FBI opens the Trump-Russia investigation. Then, on August 8th, you get the text messages between Peter Strzok and Lisa Page saying, "No, we'll stop him," regarding the Trump presidency. So it is inconceivable to think that on August 8th, they're not talking about stopping Trump through the vehicle of the investigation that they just got opened. And remember, it was an investigation that they got opened with Andrew McCabe's assistance, the same Andrew McCabe who is caught lying four times, thrice under oath, by the Inspector General. So that happens on August 8th. No, we'll stop him. Then on August 15th, you get the text messages between Strzok and Page regarding the insurance policy. You'll remember that. Following the insurance policy messages, on August 17th, you have the first defensive briefing from the FBI to the Trump campaign. Now remember, the defensive briefing is supposed to be a warning. It's supposed to be a collaborative, helpful effort. It's supposed to be the FBI saying, "Hey, Trump campaign, there may be some Russians who are trying to discredit you or discredit our election or discredit the elections process, and we're here to give you the tools to be on the lookout for those very things." The reality is, now that we've seen the declassified memos from that defensive briefing, it was in fact an effort to entrap and ensnare President Trump and Michael Flynn. The FBI was supposed to be warning President Trump and the Trump campaign that they could be a target of Russian interference, but the reality was it was our own government, the FBI, engaged in the targeting of the Trump campaign and thus their own endeavor for interference. Now, how do we know that this was a targeting endeavor and not an endeavor to warn and assist and help? You need look no further than the cover page from the memos and transcripts generated from the August 17th meeting. And what label do they put on the cover page? Crossfire Razor. Now, why does Crossfire Razor matter? That is the name of the investigation to go after Michael Flynn. So this wasn't defensive, it was offensive. This wasn't about Russian meddling and Russian interference. This was about targeting from the FBI directed at President Trump and General Flynn. And oh, by the way, who did the FBI send to go and engage in this defensive briefing? They sent Peter Strzok, the very same person talking about the insurance policy and the stoppage of a Trump presidency. They sent FBI lawyer Kevin Kleinsmith. Kleinsmith was the person who absolutely changed and altered evidence before the FISA court. That's not even in dispute anymore. The Obama-appointed inspector general found that. And Kleinsmith is likely, I think, to go to prison as a consequence of altering that evidence. And he's there as Strzok's wingman, along with Joe Pienka, who has his own problems and shouldn't even have been there in the first place. I broke the news yesterday on Lou Dobbs' program. Here's that interview.
He is Congressman Matt Gaetz, member of the House Judiciary Committee, Armed Services Committees. His new book is called Firebrand, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the MAGA Revolution. It's available for pre-order now, and we are delighted to have its distinguished author, that is Congressman Matt Gaetz. Matt, great to have you with us.
John Ratcliffe, within the last few hours, has just declassified the memo that describes the August 17th briefing the FBI gave President Trump back in the 2016 election. Now, the FBI had been telling us that this was a defensive briefing, but the evidence that we have today proves that this was a setup of the president and of Michael Flynn. Here's how. You'll remember that at the end of July in 2016, the FBI opened the Trump-Russia Russia investigation. On August 8th, Peter Strzok and Lisa Page were saying, no, we'll stop him. On August 15th, the insurance policy. And then August 17th is the first defensive briefing that the Trump campaign gets. And who does the FBI send? Peter Strzok, Kevin Kleinsmith, who was the lawyer that literally changed evidence before the FISA court, and Joe Pianca, who shouldn't have been there in the first place. And in that meeting, they weren't trying to warn the Trump campaign. They were literally trying to ensnare Michael Flynn. And on the documents released today, they are labeling that meeting as part of the Crossfire Razor investigation, which was the Flynn investigation. So they should have been there to protect the president from any Russian interference. Instead, they were there to frame the president and try to put pressure on Michael Flynn. This is what we've been talking about for years now, even more evidence that it's the case.
My colleague and friend Jim Jordan was on the Hannity program to discuss these breaking insights from the August 17th defensive briefing. Here's Congressman Jordan.
The FBI went to then-candidate Trump, told him Russia might try to target you and your campaign. What they didn't tell him is, we're targeting you. They told him Russia might try to spy on you. What they didn't tell him is, we're spying on you, and they did it just 17 days into this investigation. It opens on July 31st. August 17th, they do this. 13 minutes for the defensive briefing, the part of the briefing he's supposed to get, and then an hour and 42 minutes where they're trying to get information and set the president up. All this comes after, as you said, Sean, the August 8th text message where Peter Strzok says, we'll stop Trump, and the August 15th text message where he says, we got an insurance policy, and they start implementing that insurance policy 2 days later.
Coronavirus is causing us to rethink so many of the assumptions we've made about regulation and businesses and liquidity. And certainly in these times, our small businesses are the most fragile to the dynamics and changes in economic conditions and regulatory impulses from governors and mayors, whether there's occupancy restrictions or certain types of mandates or indoor, outdoor, different protocols that people have to follow. And so with this changing environment, I'm proud to see that the Trump administration is doing all that is possible to deregulate maybe some of the different standards and protocols that are less relevant today than prior to coronavirus, while we are having to, of course, retailer regulations to ensure that the public is safe as we reopen and revive the American economy. Jovita Carranza has the report from Fox Business. In coronavirus economy, Trump administration pulling out all the stops to help small businesses, according to the SBA administrator. And there are certain features here when it comes to lending that are critically important to small business. Small business essentially needs two things to get rolling: cash and customers. And obviously, coronavirus has impacted the customers, and with banks having to push through these PPP loans and deal with their own challenges, we have needed, some relief to create that liquidity in small businesses and to give them the resources to be able to make the investments that might be necessary for the safety protocols that can lead to more cash and customers. So these regulatory changes are increasing the approval rates for loans for small businesses with our banks. That is critically important. And in May and June, you know, more than 7.5 million of the 22 million jobs that were lost, were lost in our small business sectors. And so I think that it's critically important to remember that and to know that this is an element of the economy that requires some special attention. We believe that these regulatory changes will have to continue to be ongoing as states continue to shuffle the dynamic at which they'll allow reopening. But it's great to see the Trump administration, particularly in the area of lending, maybe reining back a little on the regulation, getting the cash out the door, getting the American economy roaring again through the small businesses that function as the backbone of this great nation. The Sierra Club is a left-leaning group. I've worked with them from time to time on issues of environmental protection and preservation because I love our environment, and I want to keep it clean and beautiful and unfilthy. But the Sierra Club now is having to cancel one of its own founders and most revered members, John Muir. That's right, the California organization having to come to some reckoning with the history and past statements of some of California's founding fathers. It's time to take down some of our own monuments, starting with some truth-telling about the Sierra Club's early history, the organization said, and we're getting this report from the LA Times' managing editor, and additionally, along with Muir, founders of the Sierra Club, Joseph LeConte and David Starr Jordan, were apparently white supremacists, and Jordan was a believer in eugenics. Muir is one of the most revered figures in California history. His writings greatly influenced the environmental movement, and the gripe with Muir and LeConte and Starr Jordan apparently is that the land that they were trying to save was in many circumstances taken away from indigenous people in California. There were Indians that occupied a lot of this beautiful country that the Sierra Club would go on to change and save and preserve. But folks were there previously, and it appears as though Muir and some of these other folks wanted to see them off of that land so it could be preserved for others. Muir was depressingly conventional on matters of race, afflicted with a garden variety Victorian white supremacism, writer Daniel DeWayne wrote in a Times opinion piece back in 2015. So this is something that the Sierra Club has reckoned with, and now the club is outlining plans to make the group better reflect the diversity in America today as the organization deals with the legacy of this past. Apparently, Muir held bigoted views toward Indians. He called them dirty. He called them superstitious, deadly, lazy, squirrelish, and wife-stealing. Wife-stealing, that seems remarkably specific and potentially personal. But wife-stealing is one of the critiques that Muir launches in a bigoted way against a group of people. Here's my hot take. We should judge people based on the best contributions that they make, and of course context regarding anything that is uncouth or off-color or unfitting with our time and reflection today is important context, but I'm not ready to cancel John Muir. I'm not ready to cancel the Sierra Club. I think that if people are able to express a positive contribution, if they're able to bring greater enlightenment or understanding in one issue, but perhaps they didn't bring that same enlightenment and understanding to other issues such as race or indigenous people or other cultural elements of their time, it doesn't mean that we take down the statues of Muir. Muir is an important person when we think about the environment, not just in terms of what it can do for us, but its inherent and intrinsic beauty. Muir is pictured with former President Teddy Roosevelt on the front of this LA Times piece, and Roosevelt really had an understanding of conservation that was pretty serving of the human beings, right? I mean, Roosevelt believed that we ought to conserve public lands because humans would benefit from the exploitation and enjoyment of those lands through hunting and fishing and hiking and a lot of the things that Roosevelt liked to do. Muir, I think, substantially improves upon that perspective of conservation by saying, in addition to human enjoyment, conservation can be an important end unto itself. We should conserve not just for the sake of humans, but for the sake of conservation itself, for the sake of replenishing our air and filtering our water and allowing the earth to be able to heal from some of the things that human beings do to pollute her. And so I think that Muir makes very strong arguments in favor of conservation for conservation's sake. Obviously, the arguments he makes regarding indigenous peoples are not reflective of what we think today or even what we should have been thinking at the time. But it was a perspective. It was a widely held perspective in the day. And I just don't believe that we should go around canceling Americans based on the worst things that they thought and said. I think that's important context, but to love and uphold Americanism, we also have space to celebrate the meaningful enlightenment that people like Muir brought to our national conversation regarding conservation. I won't cancel Muir, even if his own club, the Sierra Club, is so woke that they now feel the pressure to do so. President Trump is back leading press briefings of the Coronavirus Task Force. Let's listen into the president.
Our case fatality rate continues to decline, and we want to push this rate even lower. The therapeutic research continues daily on new and very promising treatments, including antibody treatments and the use of blood thinners and steroids. A lot of different things are happening, and a lot of things are coming out that we wouldn't have known a number of months ago. We're doing tremendously well on therapeutic research and tremendously well on the vaccines. And frankly, therapeutically, or maybe a word even beyond that word, is cure, would be the best of all. And we'll see what happens. But that would be great if we could go into the hospital and just cure people. And we're at a position where we're actually able to a certain extent, with what we have right now, and we think that in a very short period of time, we'll be able to do that.
The Republican National Convention in Jacksonville has been called off. Here are the remarks of the president.
So I told my team it's time to cancel the Jacksonville, Florida component of the GOP convention. We'll be starting in North Carolina for the Monday, as has always been planned. We were never taking that off. That's remaining as it is. The delegates are going to get together. That's where they do their nomination. So the delegates are going to North Carolina, and they'll be doing the nomination. And we're going to do some other things with tele-rallies and online the week that we're discussing, which will be really good. I think we're going to do it well. And I'll still do a convention speech in a different form, but we won't do a big crowded convention per se. It's just not the right time for that.
And while it's certainly disappointing for Floridians and Republicans and supporters of the president to not have the big, raucous, exciting convention that we were looking forward to, I can understand the concerns. Bringing people in from all over the country, the necessary movement on buses and transportation in and out of convention sites, the gathering of folks who would necessarily be yelling and cheering and potentially projecting virus on others is a risk that the president didn't want to have to take. And so in our politics, where assembly has always been so essential to the energy and enthusiasm that drives successful movements, we will have to adjust. And that's not just a Republican dynamic. That's a dynamic for all people involved in all politics. There will likely be a real enhanced emphasis on digital communication and digital organizing. Matter of fact, I can't imagine any other election in American history where the onboarding of supporters to digital platforms would be more important. And the Trump campaign has successfully onboarded, I think, over 60 million people to some digital platform or another that they are involved with. And so it's great to see that there still remains an opportunity for people to organize and interact and share ideas politically, even if we all can't get together in Jacksonville and wave our pom-poms. Russia report. UK considers tougher security laws after criticism by members of parliament. This coming to us from the BBC, and it appears as though our friends in the United Kingdom are going to copy some of the resiliency efforts that we've engaged in the United States to ensure that where there are foreign agents, potentially foreign spies in our country, that we have mandatory registration requirements for those agents, and that we keep pretty good tabs on those who may be collecting intelligence in our country. So I'm glad to see that the UK wants to be more resilient, wants to be safer and more secure, and I think that this is an innovation that is uniquely American, to want to know who's in your country, why, and then to have the ability to take action when necessary to expel those folks. And it seems noteworthy here to again draw attention to the fact that no American administration in recent times has been as tough on Russia as the Trump administration, with dozens of their quote-unquote diplomats, who, by the way, are spies in many cases, being expelled from our country following Russia's malign influence. Russia is a declining power, but she may be more dangerous in her decline than she ever was in her ascent. They have essentially blurred the lines in Russia between criminal behavior and government behavior. And that's not to say that they don't still pose danger to the world. It's in fact thugs and criminals and cartels on our southern border that bring us so much of a challenge. And so I think we've got to keep an eye on Russia, But we also should remember that Russia is not this like grand, you know, power with intense control over many satellite nations the way they used to be. It looks as though most folks are trying to get out of Russia with all of the cash and arms that they're able to steal and launder in the time being. And so the resiliency efforts by the UK are important. The accountability efforts by the Trump administration are noted and critical to ensure that we push back against Russian malign influence while keeping in mind Russia is not the grand foe that we face. China is. That should be the focus of our country because that is what will determine who wins the 21st century. Does Joe Biden want people breathing up his nostrils? A strange question indeed. Listen to the former vice president.
And I had a nurse at Walter Reed Hospital who would bend down and whisper in my ear.
Wow.
They'd go home and get me pillows. They would make sure they'd actually, probably nothing ever taught in, you can't do it in the COVID time, but they'd actually breathe in my nostrils to make me move, to get me moving.
I have talked to a number of nurses, and I do not know the medical remedy that would require someone to breathe up the nose of someone else in an effort to awaken them. And by the way, if Joe Biden needs people breathing up his nose to wake up, that is probably a warning sign that he might not be ready to be president of the United States. So who knows? We've had Joe talking about children rubbing his hairy legs at the pool, confusing his wife and his sister, asking people to vote for him for the United States Senate instead of the presidency, and now a little bit of titillating nostril activity. Weird. Thanks for listening to Hot Takes. I'm Congressman Matt Gaetz. We always appreciate your ratings and reviews. We hope you'll share our podcast content so that more folks are able to interact with these ideas and issues and research. And we hope you'll be back next week for more Hot Takes.